The ACN podcast is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners and sponsors, including the Agile Alliance. As a nonprofit membership organization, the Agile Alliance is an excellent resource to help you along your Agile journey. To learn more about the Agile Alliance and our other sponsors, as well as how you can become a sponsor or supporter of our show, please visit acnpodcast.org for more information. And thank you for your support. Good morning and good evening, everyone. This is the Agile Coaching Network. The Agile Coaching Network is brought to you by the Agile Alliance. If you don't know who the Agile Alliance is, we're a member-supported organization. We've been in existence since the manifesto was signed. So please go give a look over to agilealliance.org to kind of get an idea for what we do as an organization, because your investment and your time that you put in into this great community of practice helps us to do things like the Agile Coaching Network and a whole bunch of other different programs to help make Agile better. So I'd like to kick off today's conversation with a couple of articles that I was reading over the last couple of weeks. I was at an Agile event in Portugal, and there were some conversations on this, as well as some of the online conversations. There was a couple of Forbes articles as well. And specifically, it was talking about whether or not, what's the innovation killer in your business? And one person that I had a conversation with in Portugal was a little bit iffy on if Agile was killing or helping innovation within their company. And so with this, I was thinking about what perspective, if we were thinking about Agile in the context of innovation itself. One of the things that's always been a theory is that we have a set of constraints that are in the system. Those constraints are either beneficial constraints, meaning that they help to focus people on a particular delivery or a particular goal that we need to get to. But in other factors, if these are too constraining, they start to inhibit the system and not allow people to have enough time or resource or other things that's necessary in order for them to be able to innovate. And in the theory of constraints, it's quite simple, is just how can we systematically improve the constraint system within the business so that it's no longer the limiting factor with whatever we're trying to go accomplish. And in the case of innovation, as you know, we're trying to come up with new ideas, new ways of approaching different problems that we have, and basically to reach out ways that we can accelerate coming up with new developments itself. And so I started thinking about all of these different methods, and we started brainstorming at this one session that I was at. Is Scrum an innovation killer? Is DAFE an innovation killer? Is TDD an innovation killer? Any of the other hundreds of different Agile methods that are currently today, or even maybe the Agile mindset itself, are those the constraints that are inhibiting us from using Agile in an effective way for innovation? So I'd like to kick off the question is, what part of Agile is helping innovation? And what are some of the areas that we need to improve it in order to be able to improve how Agile helps innovation itself? And Linda, did you want to take a crack at the first part of this?
Hi, Ray. Yes, this is Linda. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining the session today. So I think this is a very interesting question. In of itself, there are very few aspects that sort of require innovation, if you would want to say that. So on the plus side, I think we're using Agile practices and methods helps us to be more innovative is really through retrospectives. As a practice in of itself, it's a time we stop to reflect. And it's in those moments where we allow ourselves that time to think, that we get the brain muscles moving and we start thinking of how could we be different. That in of itself, while it's not, defined as innovation, to me does create the space for new thoughts and ideas to percolate up and get into the team. So I think by that practice, Agile supports innovation. In the methodology specifically, SAFe actually calls out innovation as a defined event in their process. And while we could debate some of the merits of SAFe and not, I would say at a minimum, at least they do call out a pause in a very rigorous cycle of activities that's intended for teams to stop and reflect and innovate. So I'd say that, that's certainly a plus. On the downside, I think folks who are consistently using Scrum and Scrum-like practices, whether they have a 2-week cycle, a 3-week cycle, or some other cycle, it tends to become a grind. And that in of itself, the repetitive nature of always being on, always moving from one activity to the next, I think tends to be an inflation downer sort of thing. Innovation,
sure.
Sorry.
Sure. Matt Hendrick, do you have an opinion on this?
Of course. I have seen the effects of introducing capital A Agile. And it's a bit like Linda was also suggesting here. In Agile implementations, usually what's not on the backlog isn't done. So if innovation is not on your backlog, innovation doesn't happen. That's in short what I've seen in a number of companies. Then the safe approach of making a pause every now and then is already a step maybe into the right direction. But generally, it's not so that you can say, okay, every 3 weeks we just pause and then everybody becomes creative all of a sudden and produces a lot of great new ideas. Usually ideas come and innovation, the definition of innovation for me is creating value from ideas. And there's two steps in there. One thing is creating these ideas, and this is a constant flow of ideas that you need to capture. And then creating value out of them, they're actually, Agile is good at that. So I would distinguish two things, creating ideas, and there maybe design thinking is the better approach. I wouldn't look too much into Agile there. And then creating the value out of the found ideas, here Agile actually can help. So what I've arrived at in the meantime is that you maybe need to have two parts either of your organization, or you need to split this generating ideas and the design thinking part maybe from the Agile executional part of your company. So that's a bit what I've seen and observed and found useful.
Sure. Jörg, how about yourself?
I agree with Henrik a lot. So it's really about having those ideas and making them flow. It's not a point in time where you can do this. This doesn't work in any methodology. You can't force really innovation on people. You need to give a bit of space and time. And I've seen teams that actually ask for this time actively, and they just ask for certain, let's say, innovative brainstorming, however you call it, additional time at the end of sprints. And that's a good practice. I can advise that sometimes you make people aware that this will happen and that they have a certain say in what they can innovate on. Because the direction, as Henrik said, what do I want to achieve is the first thing. If you don't approach your goals with the Agile mindset of I need to think about what matters, then you will not discover that innovation matters, but you think it's natural and just happening out of the blue, and that's not true. You need to listen for it. The good ideas will go away if you don't listen. So that's just a standard practice as well. And very simple. If you don't have a bit of fun while you're doing your work, you will not be innovative anyway, regardless of method.
I fully agree with that. Fun actually does lead to some innovations. Raven, you have your hand up. What would you like to add?
Yes. Hi, Ray. So, you know what? I just want to go back to the basics of what the definition of Agile means. And in its bare bone shape, it's just to create and respond to change, right? And so, you know, with that said, if you're going to do innovation is just a new idea. It's a new solution. And in order to do that, you have to create and respond to change. You have to be able to inspect and adapt and, you know, receive feedback. So making that feedback or making that information more transparent to others so that you can get more feedback to perfect or for the betterment of whatever you're trying to create.
Okay. Can I ask a clarifying question in that? So, I mean, if you look at like Scrum, sometimes people implement Scrum with a more disciplined fashion. So Scrum masters and product owners are really constraining the system towards delivery of the existing backlog. Do you think that is that a plus factor to that, or are there people just doing Scrum wrong?
So I don't believe, I'll say this. This is what I usually say, that not everyone practices Scrum to all of the rules that have been given. However, if you follow and believe the 12 principles of Agile and you believe in the values of agility, you can create your own framework. So it is what is best for the organization. And I hope I've kind of answered your question. I don't necessarily look at it as a right or wrong way as you practice agility. I look at it as what's best. Maybe portions of Scrum work. Maybe we implement a little bit of Kanban to put limits in, and maybe that helps us as an organization. Or maybe we use a little bit of XP. It all depends. But I don't believe in the notion of wrong in agility.
Okay, very good. Ashwini, are you there?
Yes. So my take on this is like Agile helps innovation because of the continuous improvement that's part of Agile and agility. We continuously receive feedback. We continuously encourage process improvement, technical capabilities, solutions. All that are part of this continuous improvement. And we encourage the team to be, taking this forward and have the transparency so that the leadership and all the team members are aware of what is required and what needs to be done in a priority order. The other thing, in my organization, we practice SAFe, and we have inspect and adapt print that happens at the end of every program increment. And we have hackathon kind of activities, which brings in innovation. People are so excited to be part of it as they can do something different than what they do on a regular basis. And this has led to get a lot of problems solved and a lot of out-of-the-box solution come out due to this hackathon kind of events. The other aspect of Agile that I appreciate is about the self-autonomous team, where the team makes the decision. The team members are someone who is very close to the problem, and they understand and know how to solve it better than anybody else. So they making a decision, coming up with the solution, they all bring in innovation, a lot of new ideas generated, a lot of efficiency built in because of the whole Agile value that we carry along with this model.
Very good. Thank you very much. Bruce, what do you have on this subject?
I just like to add to what people are already talking about out there. I like what I'm hearing. I think part of it is how empowered is your development team. If they're kind of constrained on how it is they approach things, if you have a product owner who is focused on delivery of bits and parts and pieces that they will be able to use, it's going to be very difficult for them to sit back and learn new approaches, investigate things they might, they're being forced, like I said, to work on delivery. So the bottom line to me is, does your product owner value refactoring or not? If they only look at the value of things that they can see, they are unfortunately going to be learning very late in the process that things take longer to build because the developers weren't allowed to go back and fix things in order to stop and learn perhaps new approaches to things. So don't have an empowered dev team if the PO doesn't understand what refactoring value gives them as value on down the road, you're going to really stifle the innovation.
So in this particular case, if you're trying to push everything out the door and you are not building slack into the system by having clean code and refactoring it often so that you can build things quicker, then you're saying that this is how an overpowering product owner who just has one thing on their mind, just deliver, could impact them. Is that kind of a good summary?
Yeah, I say, do they value it? Do they look at this as slack, or do they look at it as something where they are going to continue to benefit on faster and quicker business value delivery in the future?
Sure. Thank you for that. Persona.
Yeah, hi. So kind of like what I hearing from all the people here, like I just want to add to what everyone's saying. Like it's like Agile doesn't kill anything. It's been a recent trend on a lot of different topics that's coming up. Agile kills this, Agile kills that, and Agile's. It's basically how we kind of adapt it and use it is what killing or making things. So I mean, Ellen has a great blog on like discover to deliver stuff, right? So I feel like the discovery part of things, that's where a lot of innovation happens, and then Agile helps you deliver the what you have discovered faster. And the recent things about like design thinking and the lean startup methods, problem solving phase, and then combining that with the agile methods on like faster and incremental delivery and focusing on the learnings and pivoting based on what we get. that's kind of, I guess that will kind of go hand in hand in enabling the innovation rather than killing it. So it's the Agile focuses more on the building the products right or the things right. And then we need to focus on other things that use other techniques for building the right products, right? So that's, okay. That's what I think.
Oh, that's very good. Mohammed.
Hi. Thank you. I believe that one very important factor is the self-organizing characteristic of Scrum. So that in itself, compared to a traditional organization, help people become more creative and innovative. I understand that the overall culture of the organization is very important, as one of the participants, you know, commented a few minutes ago. But I guess that just the characteristic of self-organizing is very powerful in Scrum and Agile.
I fully agree with that. I'm pleased to hear the Agilists on this call take the impression that we can be at least mindful of the constraints that we build into our own systems. And I think that in the case of innovation work that I've done in the past, we understood that the constraints of the system we were using, and we knew that in certain cases that perhaps Scrum wasn't the best methodology to go use for maybe the big front-end ideation stuff. It was different methods that allowed us to learn quicker. Let me go ahead and switch off to the main questions that are up over on Slido. So the top question that we have up here is from Cindy. This is another metrics question. We get a lot of metrics questions over the number of years that we've been doing this, but we'll go ahead and go for this again. Is there a value of determining metrics based on time cycle? What metrics are the organizations using and providing to leadership for visibility on team performance? Hendrik or Jorg or Linda, do you want to take a first crack at this one?
I think the first crack for me is that the teams should own the team's performance. It's not the managers who own the team performance. So in that sense, I'm very allergic against using metrics to see, like, I mean, especially when I've heard this from a couple of companies. Fortunately, it doesn't happen in the company I work for, that people use velocity, burndown, speed, and so on for measuring and comparing teams. And that makes, I think, the workplace extremely unsafe. So I think that's definitely not a good idea. And I think performance measurements should rather be on the outcomes of an organization rather than individuals or teams.
I strongly agree. It's totally different to observe whether you do what you intend to do as a team and learn from it, as to somebody from the outside trying to look at a metric and making a decision from this. If you want to know how the teams are doing, maybe be more part of the results. So see whether the people who are really getting the deliveries are satisfied, or if they need something different. And if they do, they maybe should join sprint interviews or whatever meetings you have to clarify whether expectations are met.
There's another aspect to this question, because the first part of the question actually is something that I like. Yeah? Determining metrics based on cycle time. Of course, we should measure a lot of stuff. The team, to improve its performance, needs certain data. So a team should observe its cycle times and maybe other things that help the team to learn and improve. But those measurements should not be owned by the management.
Agreeing with what the gentlemen have said so far, I'd like to add that one of the values that I have found useful in using cycle time is helping to understand your team's backlog health. And I can say I've seen it recently where, you know, when I look at the product backlog and I look at the full cycle time from the time an item hits the backlog as we intend to work on it at some time to when it actually gets done, there are things that are well over 8, 9, 10, 11 months old. So that's an indication that it's time to revisit that backlog and determine which of those things really do have value and you're actually going to bring forward. Understanding your backlog health, I think, helps improve planning effectiveness as well as efficiency. So, yes, I do find some value in it. And, of course, unfortunately, many of us have witnessed where metrics are used as a weapon against their own employees. And, of course, that's when the metrics take a wrong turn.
They take an evil twist.
And teaching teams how to use those metrics, I think, is another important role of who's ever leading the team, whether that's their scrum master or they have a coach. But someone should help educate them on, you know, what types of questions and should we be asking ourselves based on the data that we're seeing? And are there indicators here that would lead us to better outcomes?
Agreed. Randall, what do you think?
Yeah, I've just recently been looking at cycle time in depth and using it with the teams that I'm working with. The one thing I do like the metric, but the one thing again is like what we've been saying is that it is a single data point. It is, you should not act strictly on the cycle time, because the cycle time does not tell you, are you building the right thing? Are you doing the correct things? It just tells you how long it's taking you to do something from beginning to end. But it's not really telling you what is the value to the customer of this thing. So I think it's something that we have to use in conjunction with other metrics and just not standalone.
Okay, I agree with that as well. Daniel, what do you think?
Every time I see this, some way to measure team performance, I start thinking how the team may start gaming these metrics. And isn't it dangerous if they start breaking things, stories, and in a way that they are not exactly an increment, but they are just steps for a real story, and they decrease the cycle time and say, yeah, look, we decreased the cycle time or the time and a half, but they are not exactly the living things. They are just gaming the metric. Isn't it dangerous?
So do you believe that there's a healthy gaming, meaning that, you know, setting a goal and actually legitimately moving towards that? Or do you think that most people are just in the mode of, okay, here's what you want me to live up to, I'm going to cook the books for that? I mean, what's your view on that?
Actually, I don't know if there is a healthy metric, but I just know there is always someone trying to get a promotion, and we still think how to game, how to skip the metrics and give you what you want. You say, yeah, I need this cycle time cut in a half. Yeah, okay, I'll give it to you.
Interesting.
To add one thing, with my teams, one problem that we had is we were taking on too large of stories. And when I instituted the cycle time, they consciously brought those stories down into smaller bite-sized chunks, which is what I wanted. So in this situation, I did get a very positive reaction, you know, or effect of me, you know, measuring the cycle time. So in this situation, and I totally understand it's easy to game, you know, any metric, especially this one, but in this situation, it was a behavior I was looking for.
Okay. So in this particular case, the team rose up and said, okay, yes, I accept this challenge and I'm going to move towards it, which is good. Pamela, what do you have?
I have a question, because we are, in our organization, we are trying to show velocity versus actual completion. I was just wondering what other metrics people are using to show that projects are better off using Agile, in addition to Agile itself is a benefit over Waterfall. I know internally, you know, it's improved because we found a lot of defects and we were able to fix them there and then rather than waiting until all the development was done. But how do you measure that?
I'll take a first dive at this. I mean, one of the things that I found going from a waterfall culture to an agile culture, one was everything delivered at the end, which, you know, nothing was done until everything got tested and was ready to go into the shipment. Versus in the case of Agile, if you're doing incremental slices of functionality, value could be measured throughout the entire system itself, meaning that after a few increments, I could have something that I can demo and I can get customer feedback and understand whether or not my investment was actually a wise or not a wise one. And the way that I used to measure it is did we finish early? Did we manage scope creep better? Were the number of customer requests, were those more towards the front end of the process and less in the back because we've been listening to the customers as we went through? A slew of metrics associated to when we met minimum viable product, you know, to be able to say that we could ship if we want to, and we could ship earlier than normally a waterfall run. What I found with the waterfall stuff is it, like all projects, they fit perfectly to the deadline that was set, and we would go spend dollars on a low value feature that nobody wanted and nobody would get rid of it. And then we ended up having to go maintain it for 7 years. So I don't know what others' perspective is on that as well. Jörg, do you have an opinion on that?
Always try to approach it as you explained from the end result. So what are we delivering? What are we getting paid for? I ideally even try to get feedback from the market. What is really used in what extent from a delivery? And if this is improving over time, that's a clear indication that things are going the right way. A good metric is actually checking how people are selling your product. So talk to the salespeople, and if they are aware of things you are putting in there and sell this to the customer, that is obviously you're doing something that creates value for them and probably revenue. That's more easy than seeing what people really use. So try to think backwards from usage and see where you can grab it and then compare it to whatever you want to compare it to, waterfall data, whatever. Making the most money out of the time you spend on the product is one of the best ways to do it.
Okay. Shauna, I just activated your microphone. You are one of the colleagues that was with us over at the Business Agility Lab at Agile. What do you have on this?
One of the things, the question was, what can we provide leadership when it comes to metrics? I think what we need to understand is typically leadership is looking for metrics when either a team, there is a perceived notion that the team is not delivering something, or maybe they're needing to start new work. So leadership is like, who can we tag to give new work to? So when that happens, I think from internally, the team wants to know, how can we continuously get better? And I think that those agile metrics are really, really good for the team internally, as what's been said before. But once we can answer the question when it comes to, are we working on the right thing? And we can understand what's the adoption rate of our product and how is it being used in the market. Leadership typically starts pivoting away from the team and starts looking at the value. So I don't know if that's helpful.
I think that helps quite a bit. The person who had the question number three here, he actually said that he wanted to be present here during the next Agile Coaching Network when that one was read, because he wanted to give more context to it. So I'm going to do him a favor, and I'm going to go ahead and not do that question, and we'll go ahead and defer that to next week. So the next one is, what are the practical techniques that can help to improve the cohesiveness of teams in Agile? Jörg, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, definitely. I like to start with this one. So cohesiveness in the terms of they are working on one thing, they are putting the same measures on what makes success. So from quality to listening to customers to whatever you define, if you have a common view, cohesiveness is often very helpful in terms of they are doing the same thing in the same way. It's a threat actually of making you very blind to developments in the world and to the benefits you have from diversity. So these are the two points. But if you look at the positive side, give them shared experiences, celebrate success together, maybe even be angry if something goes really wrong. Make it feel like a team thing. Don't make it feel like a personal thing. Try to get some joint experiences, maybe even outside of work. However you feel about this, that is definitely depending on culture. But one important thing that I find as a coach, address the team if you mean the team and don't try to speak to a single person. Maybe that forces you to get up out of a chair in the meeting and walk around the room so that you're looking into the eyes of everybody at one point in time when you're trying to explain something. But to me, it's if you treat them like a team, they behave like a team. If you treat them like individuals, they behave like individuals. And if you treat them like individuals forming a team, they're probably going to do the best thing.
Yeah, I found that part of the experience of especially when our agile adoption was happening, we were very much an individual culture, and then coming into a team culture, doing team activities together, I think was very helpful. The other one, and I think you pointed on it a little bit there, Jörg, was that as a manager, we would never just go point out one person on a team that might have just delivered something and said that you're the MVP and you did, you know, all of this yourself, or make sort of this kind of declaration to the rest of the team members that they didn't somewhat have a part because of the way that the award system was. And so what we learned to do is we rewarded people as teams, and we let individuals within the team reward team members, meaning that they could go off and give a person an award because they were the MVP, but don't single one person out.
My experience with teams is that cohesiveness is pretty much about a team's daily experience. So the question is really, I mean, you can have team building events and so on, but often I've seen this to be rather artificial. So now comes the fun part. And then after the fun part, we go back to work and the cohesiveness has not so much increased. So I think it needs to become really more personal. And for that, I think it's more something for retrospectives or coaching towards the team to increase the cohesiveness. That's a bit what I've seen. I mean, the events are a good thing on top of that, but they don't often generate the cohesiveness. They are deepening it.
Okay, I believe that too.
Maybe allow me just to add to this, because okay. Sometimes if you do small events every day that have such a positive character, like bringing the first cup of coffee to all the team members, then, or sharing this or whatever, that makes a big difference. Just the one-time show, I agree with Henrik.
There is in Sweden a very nice ritual, you could say, in almost all companies. It's the Friday fika. It's on Friday afternoon, there's always somebody bringing a cake. So, and it's a round robin thing. Yeah. So every week somebody else has the responsibility to bring the cake to the team. And then you sit there and have a coffee and a little piece of cake and you are chatting with each other. And it's rituals like that that I think create more cohesiveness.
I definitely like cake. But yeah. Anyway, Shana, what do you have?
One of the things that I really like doing in teams is when we kick off the project using an agile inception. And for those of you who haven't used an Agile Inception, it's a 2 to 5 day kickoff that you do with the team where you align on the mission, on the goals, on the pain points that the team is trying to solve. And you, as Jorgen said before, it's about the shared experience. So taking the team through the end-to-end journey on what they're building, why it's important, and even having both customers and stakeholders come in and explain to the team why it's really exciting that they get to solve this problem and what it means for the organization. And by having that shared experience with the team, it really helps build cohesion on both motivation as well as aligned perceptions and that we talked about innovations and how they might innovate to solve that problem together. And it's really, really brought a lot of my teams together.
So give me an idea what the typical agenda would be in that as you walk through and kick that off. And how long does this take?
Sure. So what I typically like to do is have product use the lean canvas or a business canvas, in almost like a story form. So they go through that with the team and really talk about why this is important to the business and the impact it'll make. I then will typically have, the CEO or somebody come in and talk about why this problem is so critical to be solved for the business. And then what we do is if there's pain points that already exist, I'll actually have the team work with a customer. Sometimes maybe it'll be customer service calls, and get the team involved. So maybe that's watching the customer with a timer, having some way that we can see how long does it take, what's the workaround that they currently have. So that way we can really be involved together. Once we understand the problem as a team, maybe we'll do a hopes and fears exercise to kind of break out the risks. Then we'll do a quick sketch to draw up what the user journey might look like with our UX partners. And then finally, once we get to the end, this will be a couple days, we'll actually as a team break out the user stories. And so going through this entire experience together really, really helps gel the experience of what it is, why we're doing. And it helps us not say, well,
you, product owner, need to write all the user stories because that's your job. Instead, it's like, this is our problem to solve, and we get to do this together as a team.
Very good. Thank you for giving us some insight on how you run that.
I'm going to just add two thoughts to this around when you are trying to create cohesiveness. No, this isn't a one and done sort of thing. Creating cohesiveness is something that takes care and feeding on a regular basis. And by that, I really mean the care and feeding of your team and looking out for their needs and making sure, one, that they're heard and where practical needs are met. The other part is that the more people you have on your team, the more challenging it can become to create cohesiveness, as much just because of the multitudes of factors of personalities and cultures and communication styles and things. So it, you know, it clearly is easier to create cohesiveness with a smaller team than if you have a very large team. So those of you who might struggle with justifying smaller team size, creating cohesiveness, I think, is one of those factors.
Interesting. So let me ask a question on the measurement system, because I think sometimes when a team is not cohesive, the silent people who don't, you know, that don't feel a part of the crowd, sometimes don't speak up. Is there any method that you use to be able to help to identify the individuals who don't feel that it's a cohesive team?
So sure, I think there are two primary ways. One is that you don't start by calling them out in a group setting. It's the kind of thing where it's a good time to offer to have coffee or tea with someone and just have a conversation about, you know, how they're feeling with their role in the team and are there any concerns that they have, sort of thing. Give them an opportunity to open up and express that, you know, your intention is to help create a cohesive team. And you've noticed that they don't tend to speak out as much as some of the other people, and just learn from what they'd say about that. And then other than that, in a group setting, using silent techniques for people to voice their opinion is always helpful and helps keep the most vocal person in the room from having all of the vote or say on an item.
Allowing them to give up the microphone. Mohammed, you put your hand up. What do you
I think I just want to build and expand on what Linda said. It's a very insightful. I think it's besides the activity, it's the relationship itself within the teams that really promote cohesiveness. So as Linda said that, you know, sometime, you know, if you ask people within a group setting, they may not speak up. But if you have a relationship, then, you know, they gradually become more part of the arena. And I've experienced this, that people who are very quiet and not contributing actually have a lot to contribute. And once the relationship develops and they feel more comfortable, they trust the team members, especially the leader, then there is definitely more cohesion. And definitely in a smaller team setting, it's much easier than in a bigger team setting.
Very good. We have about less than about 10 minutes left. We could go into this next question. The question is from Judy, and I've actually went to the bottom of the list because sometimes it takes a little bit to get things up through the list, and I thought this one was kind of interesting. Has there been much success in introducing Agile and practices in the K-12 classrooms? I'll go ahead and kick this one off. I could say that my own daughter in the Montessori environment, she went in and actually taught other kids of how to go do Kanban and personal Kanban within their environment, and had a lot of great success and lots of great pictures of people, you know, them managing, you know, these young children managing their workflow. Are there others that might have seen some success in the K-12?
Ray, this is Linda again. So I have a colleague in Broward County in Florida who's been working with the Department of Education there and actually bringing formal Agile training into the K-12 classroom. I wish I had more specific information other than that she's reported that it's gone quite well and they're looking to grow it across other counties in Florida. So yes, it is happening in some cases. I don't think people have written much about it as yet, an area that would be worth pursuing.
One other place for people to go to for this is the Five Saturdays project. That's an initiative with the Agile Alliance. You go to the agilealliance.org, you'll find that under initiatives. And that particular program is targeting how do you use agile methods in primarily in the high school years. How do we use agile practices in order to breed success for studying and other different ways of using it within the curriculum itself? And that's pretty cool. Any other last comments on this one as we approach the top of the hour?
There's maybe one thing I came across here in Europe, and that is EduScrum. And so there is a movement that is called EduScrum Scrum in educational contexts, and it came from the Netherlands. There a teacher was starting to use Scrum in his classrooms teaching. So he was the product owner, and the students in the class are the teams. And then the learning curriculum is split into backlogs and executed accordingly. So he has done a couple of keynotes actually at conferences, Agile conferences. So eduscrum.org or something like that is the web address if you're interested in that.
Awesome. Thank you for that. I'm going to go ahead and ask that question that we did last month, and it was pretty popular. What are you reading? Are you reading right now? Because I'm going to the Agile Testing Days conference in about a week, I'm rereading Agile Testing, different books about Agile Testing. How about others?
Hi, Ray. This is Muhammad Tahir. The book name is A Simpler Way. This is written by two authors, Wheatley and Kellen Roy. And if I try to, summarize it, it's about their thesis of philosophy is that the life, the world itself is self-organizing in nature. So life tends to, although through messy processes or messy ways, it tends to seek meaning. It tends to seek systems. So what it means is that we need to encourage those things and not bring constraint. So I think it's a beautiful, it's kind of a meditative short book. It is very, I think it's would be very inspirational for agile profession.
Thank you. And give me that full name one more time.
A Simpler Way, written by Margaret Wheatley and Myron Kellner Rogers. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing their names right.
That's okay, but thank you. Another person on the comments online says that they're reading at scale. They did not put the author name there. Others, you want to contribute what book you might be reading?
Yeah, this is Linda. Just started reading a book titled Lab Rats, How Silicon Valley Made Work Miserable for the Rest of Us by Dan Lyons.
Yes.
As I said, I'm just getting started, and I can tell you that it is a thought-provoking and disturbing account of what some of the impacts we've brought on society with the advances in technology and the creation of all the millionaires that have come out of the new technology companies that have, spawned out of the last 20 years. And it actually does take to account Agile and some of the practices we're doing in the Agile and Lean community, pokes a lot at Lego Serious Play. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested, challenged about what you believe about Agile and how we're helping society, it's worth a listen.
One interesting thing about that book is, yes, I read that as well. And my knee-jerk reaction was, and I posted that up on Amazon as a review, was it felt to me that the person who authored the book was only superficially looking at Agile, but I had to reread it again because, that's the mark, I guess, of a decent book is that you don't have to agree with it. But yes, I do agree with, some of the context that you bring up. Any last minute books anyone wants to throw out?
Sure. I'm reading the book. I just started reading the book Edge, Value-Driven Digital Transformation. Dear friend Linda Liu is a co-author of it. And it's really about how difficult agile transformation is when there's things like budgets, budget planning and portfolio planning, and how might we look at changing the way that businesses plan their budgets and they themselves need to act more agile.
Oh, very good. Well, we are at the top of the hour. I'd like to thank everyone for contributing this hour. And for those of you who are lurking, that is okay too. But again, thank you for all the comments. If you want to visit me, I will be at the Agile Testing Days conference near Berlin starting next week. I'm going to actually be teaching a Kanban class there, actually a Kanban journaling class, which means using Kanban from a journal. So it's an experiment. Hopefully it'll go over well after that. And it won't be for a formal event, but I'll be with the supporting Agile adoption team over, where's that, Hendrik, again? Where are we going to be at? We're going to be in Stockholm, correct?
In Stockholm at Ericsson in Kista, the suburb of Stockholm. And we will enjoy the Swedish winter.
Yes. And if you guys are in Stockholm, you know, this is going to be in December, you know, we'll send out, maybe you guys can meet us at a local pub or something. It'd be great to have a conversation. With that, thank you. This podcast is provided by Agile Alliance for educational and informative purposes only. To find out more information about the member-supported Agile Alliance, please go to agilealliance.org to find out about more upcoming events, as well as different programs that are available to help you with your Agile journey.